Thanks very much for that very generous introduction and invitation, Harold. Can you hear me back out there? Is that okay? Okay. So I want to share with you the excitement of the discovery of gravitational waves. I think most of you would have heard at least one talk, maybe two, three, four, five, not sure how many. And I hope this is not just another one. And I hope to tell you a bit more or something that you've not heard before. Before I do that, I would like to thank the LIGO Scientific Collaboration. This discovery and the science that you hear today is the effort of thousands of scientists and engineers, most importantly, graduate students and postdocs, hundreds of them in the collaboration, 80 different institutes across different, 15 different countries. So it's a massive collaboration. I want to thank also our colleagues here in Toronto. CETA has played a very instrumental role in the discovery of gravitational waves. In fact, let me begin by showing one of the simulations they carried out. Our story really goes back to more than a billion years in a galaxy far, far away, to black holes going around each other. They twisted and turned the space-time around them, creating a ripple in the very fabric of space-time, which traveled out to infinity. And 1.3 billion light years, these ripples, which were generated, they traveled along tirelessly without any dispersion, apart from their amplitude falling off with distance. They traversed towards us, and roughly about 1.3 billion light years, they hit the LIGO detector in Livingston. This is an interferometric detector located in Livingston, Louisiana, in the US. And about 7 milliseconds later, they hit the one in the Hanford, which is up north, northwest, from southwest to northwest. And this is the reason why we know that these gravitational waves came somewhere from the southern hemisphere, although we're not entirely sure. So how did we make this discovery and what happened? If you look at the LIGO control room on that day, then you would see something peculiar going on. What you see is that at exactly 9:53:51 Universal Time on 14th of September 2015, you see an event with a signal-to-noise ratio of 23. This has to be put in context. The level at which we are seeking to make a detection of first gravitational waves were around 10 or 12. And here is a whopping signal of signal-to-noise ratio of 23. This was not a detection pipeline that was geared up to detecting signals of this kind. So it went and looked for what is the false alarm probability of this event, and it said it's 1 per 3 years you would get a signal like this. If you then translate it to what we were saying about the kind of alerts we should get interested in, it was 1 per a month, maybe 1 per 1 year. But this was 1 per 3 years. The final number that you will see is 1 per something like 7,000 years or better. In fact, we can't even constrain the so-called false alarm rate. But a few months later, this was such a massive event. It was unbelievable. And we, for a little while, thought that some crazy postdoc has injected a signal in our data right on the first day of the science run just to trick us. But a few months later, to be more precise, on December 26th, we had another event. The time there was 3:38:53 UTC. It was still Christmas night back here. So some of our colleagues would like to think that this was a Christmas gift. But we call it a Boxing Day event. So this event showed up and with signal to noise ratio off the level, at the level that we were hoping to make our first detection. So this proved that it's not a fluke. But this time, the pipeline that was used to make the detection was actually the one that was looking for binary black holes. So we didn't do that in the beginning because we thought binary black holes, first of all, are not so promising for first detection. And also because the goal of making an online search was to send triggers to astronomers. And black holes, they don't emit light. They emit only sound in the form of gravitational waves. So people thought it is very uninteresting to search for them online. We would definitely look for them offline, but not online. And that trigger was produced just 70 seconds after the actual event occurred. And you will appreciate what a wonderful achievement that is when I later on tell you how we look for these things. So this pipeline was able to immediately characterize what's the false alarm rate, and that is about 1 per 950 years, 1 per 1,000 years. The final significance of this event is also something that we cannot completely quantify. It's so rare, this event too, that it's a confirmed detection as far as we are concerned. So with this, we think black holes, in fact binary black holes, are plentiful in nature. Not only did we detect these two events that I talked about, but also one on October 12th, 2015, is what we call a marginal event. Its signal-to-noise ratio, instead of being 11 or 12, is only about 9.5, 9.8. But that small difference makes the significance orders of magnitude worse. And so we can't claim this to be a confirmed detection. What does this discovery mean, really? First of all, this is not only first direct detection of gravitational waves. Direct is the key word there, because gravitational waves, their existence has been known since 1975 when Taylor and Weisberg actually made very precise measurement of the orbits of binary neutron stars and showed that they are shrinking due to emission of gravitational waves, and there is no explanation. For this, Hulse and Taylor were awarded Nobel Prize in 1992. But this is definitely the first direct detection, not the indirect influence of gravitational waves on an astronomical system. This is also the first time black holes have been observed directly. Not the influence of the gas surrounding the black hole on the black hole's influence on the surrounding gas and dust, but rather directly the influence of the black hole on the space-time itself. And I will tell a couple of more things about that later on. This is the first observation of a black hole binary. So several firsts in this discovery, because black hole binaries of this kind probably cannot be observed in any other way. And if we can, that would actually be a very groundbreaking event in fundamental physics, not just astrophysics. If we can detect binary black holes by their electromagnetic emission, it would tell something fundamental about black holes and their properties. The radiated energy in this event exceeds the something like 3 solar masses. That is the radiated energy, that's the total energy, converted into pure oscillations of the fabric of space-time itself. And the luminosity in gravitational waves briefly exceeded 3.6 into 10 to the 56 Earth per second. If you go and look at that number, that exceeds the luminosity in the entire electromagnetic spectrum, that is from all the stars in all the galaxies in the universe. So it's such a violent and bright event. Now, the significance is that until then, the only fundamental waves that we had known were those of Maxwell and Faraday and others who worked on the theory of light, that they are oscillations of electric and magnetic fields. Soon after propounding his theory of gravity, Einstein predicted that similar to Maxwell's theory of light, there is gravitational wave theory of his theory of gravitation. But for the rest, I mean, not only, that was not the only prediction of Einstein. He also, his theory, although not himself, his theory predicted the existence of black holes, Big Bang, and gravitational waves. It's an irony, therefore, that for the rest of his life, Einstein went on to disprove the existence of all these three. Of course, during his lifetime, Big Bang was hinted at, the expansion of the universe was hinted at. That was a great vindication for his theory. Black holes, solutions were known, but he didn't believe that these objects existed. They were called singularities and things that are some bizarre consequences of his theory and gravitational waves. He even tried to write papers, although he could not completely succeed in proving that gravitational waves don't exist. So therefore it was unfathomable to Einstein, let alone theoretical problems, detecting these waves at the time when he was conceiving these ideas. It was completely inconceivable. We often say that these gravitational waves are very ripples in the fabric of space-time. So I want to take a step back and explain to our younger audience as to what that means. We all understand what a curved space means. It is simply the fact that the distance between different points in space can be altered due to the presence of a mass. So the distance that is measured along this direction here for the same number of grid points is not the same as here. So we understand what curved space means. What's curved time? Curved time is the rate at which clocks run is different according to different observers. If you are out here on the surface of the Earth, the clock is running at a certain rate. But if you go and dangerously leave close to your black hole, like this Gargantua, then time runs far more slowly. So that's the meaning of a curved time, and this is precisely the principle of detection of gravitational waves. They make use of the fact that time runs at different rates in the presence of gravitational waves as opposed to the absence of gravitational waves, and compares them using that famous instrument, the interferometer of Michelson-Morley, which was the one that helped Einstein to conceive his special theory of relativity, except that the Michelson-Morley experiment has been improved by 11 orders of magnitude. Instead of 0.7 femtosecond difference in the two arms, which is what they achieved, we have improved that measurement accuracy by 11 orders of magnitude in roughly 110 years. So one order of improvement in 10 years or so. So gravitational waves, therefore, are emitted by dynamical objects in space-time, and those ripples travel out. But in order to bend space-time, it's not ordinary processes. I'm shaking my hands and moving about. I'm certainly creating some tiny ripples on the fabric of space-time, but not so great. Why is it? Let's step back a little and ask the question, how rigid is space-time? It's actually encoded in Einstein's equations. I'm aware that not all, everyone in the audience, the younger colleagues, may not have seen Einstein's equation. It's not equal to mc squared that is the most famous equation. It's really this, which says on the left-hand side, the curvature of space and time is what is on the left-hand side. So it has units of 1 upon area. And on the right-hand side, we have this quantity T alpha beta. Those are the stresses in matter, the energy, momentum, stress energy, momentum tensor. And the coupling between the two, how the curvature arises from stresses, that coupling constant is 8 pi g upon c to the power of 4. So on the one hand, you have pressure, and you have area, 1 upon area, and therefore, the units of c to the power of 4 upon g happens to be a force. And a force that is enormous. You can work it out. C to the power of 4 is a large number. G is a small number. C to the power of 4 by G is 10 to the 44 newtons. So unless the stresses are very large, you can't bend space-time. You can't create ripples in space-time. Let's do a thought experiment a la Einstein. Let's consider an orbiting body. Elementary physics tells you that the force is simply mv squared upon r, where v is the orbital speed, m is the mass of the body, and r is the distance between them. We can use Kepler's law. If this motion is really entirely due to gravity, we can use Kepler's law. You may not have seen it in that form. M by r is nothing but v squared upon g. That's Kepler's law. And you can put it in this equation here to eliminate m by r. You now have the force, the centrifugal force, purely in units of fundamental constants, c and g, and then the speed of the body. That's all. And I think this is the way we should really frame what the centrifugal force or centripetal force is from now onwards. It tells you the centripetal force is a very, very tiny fraction of this fundamental force, c to the power of 4 upon g, 10 to the 44 newtons, in most circumstances, because there is a V by C to the power of 4 sitting there. So V for Earth going around Sun is about 1,000 the speed of light, 10,000 the speed of light, somewhere in between. So this is going to be rise to the power of 4. So it's a very tiny fraction of that fundamental force, GF. It's only when you have binary black holes you can have these objects feeling that force. The reason being, in the case of Sun, even if you have orbit of Mercury shrunk very close to the surface of the Sun, you won't get the speed of the Mercury orbit close to the speed of light. So you have to shrink the size of Sun to about 1.5 kilometers and put an object very close to Sun, then you get a speed close to about the speed of light, maybe half the speed of light. And that is when you can churn the space-time to a point where the ripples really raise, very high tides are sent out. So the biggest forces in nature are those due to binary black holes and binary neutron stars, which are the most compact objects in the universe. So that's the reason why gravitational wave detectors are fundamentally detectors of black holes. Black holes not in light, but in gravity. So what did we detect? This is what I want to tell you about next. Let's look at what we search for, first of all. This is a space in which we have two masses. We basically search for a binary system. If you have a single black hole, that's not going to emit. It's just sitting there. It's not going to create any ripples. But if you have a pair of black holes, they can. So we take something like between 1 solar mass to 100 solar mass for the two component masses. That's the space. The color is how far we can tell. We can see them with our instruments. This is in units of megaparsec. 1 megaparsec is about 3 million light years. So what this is telling you is that, we can see these sources up to cosmological distances. In particular, in this region of the parameter space, we can see them up to billions of light years away. So that's our best chance, in fact. But we were not expecting these binary black hole events to be frequent enough. So that's what we search for. But how do we search? We search for them by using the expected signals from these binary black holes, and we correlate them with the data. We look for patterns in the data, hidden in the data, and we dig them out. It's really a pattern recognition technique. And when the signal is actually present, we have a big signal-to-noise ratio. When the signal is absent, it is pure instant of noise. And we have to then have a trade-off. When do we see a signal? When we don't? So that's our detection criteria, and users match filtering. And this is where the work in Toronto, in CETA, is a very important component of these searches, because unless we have very precise signals, we will miss them. So having those signals is important not only to detect, but also to estimate parameters, and I'll come back to that a little later. Our detector, however, is very noisy. We have to distinguish between signals and noise. And the way we do it is what are called signal discriminators. We not only use this match filtering, but in order to discriminate against non-stationary noise, we inject signals, that is, artificially add signals into our data, and we look for the signal-to-noise ratio, but that's not enough. We look for how different the signal is compared to the expected signal. That's what is called the chi-square. Somebody used here xi-square. They thought xi and chi are same. But don't worry, that's the chi-square, the usual chi-square statistic that is prevalent in physics. The signal population lives in this part of the parameter space, and the noise triggers live in that part of the parameter space. At low signal-to-noise ratios, we really can't tell the difference between the signal and the background noise. However, at large signal-to-noise ratios and small chi-square, you can see systematically the injected signals have small chi-square, we can discriminate them. So that's the technique that is used in order to see them. So what did we find? The first one was really lucky. The signal-to-noise ratio was so high that by just doing a band pass filter, in this particular case it was a high pass filter, applying that, we were able to see the pattern with naked eye. There was no need in reality, no need to detect, unless of course you have thousands of PhD students who can look at the data continuously, you know, churning out, you would need automated computerized analysis, and that's what was the case in this. An algorithm that was not at all looking for any particular shape was able to identify these signals. And the two instruments had that signal completely in coherence. What it means is that if you take the signal from Hanford, shift it back in time by 7 milliseconds, and flip the sign, because one of the LIGO instruments is like that, the other instrument is 180 degrees turned around, then the data from the two instruments is completely in coherence. That is the principal way we actually fight the noise in the detector in the first place. But not only that, this coherence is the one that gives us immense confidence that this is not a fluke chance. And that fluke chance, of course, is something like better than 1 per 7,000 years. But why do we think this is really a black hole? Why is it not a neutron star or maybe a white dwarf binary? There is a property that we can measure for any signal that is present in the data, which is the rate at which the frequency of the signal changes. The rate at which the frequency of the signal changes according to general relativity depends on this combination of the masses. It's called the chirp mass, because it is responsible for the signal to chirp up in frequency, and that is the one that we can measure pretty accurately. this chirp mass, given that, it says that the measurement, our measurement says, if one of the objects is a neutron star, that is about 3 solar masses, the total mass of the system has to be 1,000 solar masses. That's what it would say. And that is undetectable by LIGO. We can only detect up to something like a few hundred solar masses, 1,000 solar mass, absolutely no, total mass. But in addition to that, we can also measure the total mass from the maximum frequency up to which the signal goes. This is obvious. I mean, you take any object and you simply strike it. It has a certain characteristic frequency. And the size then tells us, that final frequency tells how big the black holes were. The smaller the black holes, higher the frequency. So from the final frequency, we can get the total mass. So we can, in fact, tell roughly what the two masses are. And these two masses are larger than the largest neutron star mass allowed by theory. So let me repeat that. We have measured the two component masses, and the masses that we get for the individual components are about 29 solar mass and 35 solar mass, and they are much larger than any neutron star mass, and so we think they are black holes. There is no other explanation currently. There is a smoking gun evidence that these are black holes, and I'll come to that in a minute. So when you compare these signals with those predicted by exact solutions of Einstein's equation, which is what Harald Pfeiffer and colleagues do on a day-to-day basis, they completely agree with the underlying data. Here is the data, these are the reconstructions, and in the middle of those reconstructions is the numerical relativity data. When you take away those reconstructions from the data, so this is the data that I showed you before, you subtract it off, what is left is completely consistent with the noise at any other time. So the residue is good. Not only that, the so-called time frequency plot shows the signature of a chirping signal, increasing frequency and amplitude as a function of time. So this is really a textbook signal, and probably one of these diagrams should go into the next edition of MTW, whenever that is going to be, and show that. But how do we measure the background and the significance of this signal? And that is done by using a clever technique, because remember, gravitational wave detectors cannot be shielded from gravity, because gravity cannot be shielded. So you have to somehow measure what is the background. That means if there are no gravitational waves in the universe, how does our instrument data look like? What we do now is to take the data from one detector and shift that relative to another detector in time, and then look for coincidences. If you shift the data from one detector relative to another by more than the right travel time between the two detectors, then any coincidence is only due to noise. It cannot be due to gravitational waves unless, of course, gravitational waves travel slower than the speed of light. That is possible, but not plausible. So we do this in order to measure the background signal, and here is the result. This is the number of events as a function of detection statistic. You can think of it as simply the signal-to-noise ratio. The number of events due to background that is computed by this time shift method is this histogram, black histogram. There are two histograms, I'll come to that. The black histogram is that. And these orange squares are when you don't shift. This is what we call zero lag data. There is no lag on top of the two detector data. So those are the real triggers. These are the false triggers due to accidental coincidences. The way this behaves, that curve is determined by the universe. How many events there are and how frequently they occur. The way this behaves is determined by the the quality of the data. And it falls off very rapidly. And this is where you can see why one of the events was a candidate event. We'll come to that in a minute. So this falls off by something like 2 to 3 orders of magnitude for every one step in signal-to-noise ratio. So an event with signal-to-noise ratio of only 10 is a million times less significant compared to something at 12, signal-to-noise ratio of 12. And that's what you're seeing here. This is the first discovery, GW-150914, Christian after its the date of its birth. And so that is the event. And that's millions and millions of times more significant than that event, which is only a candidate, because it's only slightly far away from that curve. Now that's the way we detect. What about these funny little things going on? This is because even though you shifted the two data sets, the signal is still present in both the detectors. Therefore, the signal, the true signal, will have chance coincidences with some noise events in the other detector. Those are the ones that produce those. But if you remove those signals from the data and say, oh, they are true signals, and then compute the background is much neater, as you can see. And that's this purple part of the background. That was our first detection. We got too used to it. Here's a cartoon that shows how wonderfully we got used to it. On September 15, this guy sitting close to the computer says, wow, what a beautiful chirp. You can see it in the data. But 3 months later, this guy says, where is the chirp? I can't see it. He says, dude, you're spoiled by the first event. Can't see it in the raw data, and here is the reason why. So if you look at the raw data and do the exactly the same filtering for the second event on Boxing Day, then that's the data. And the signal we think is there. That's the way it should be. But we can't see it with naked eye. You really have to do this pattern matching, match filtering to dig it out. And when you do that, our software tells us that the signal-to-noise ratio actually builds up in time in the two different instruments in this way. Okay? And they peak just within 1 millisecond of each other. In the second event, the difference in the two arrival times is only 1 millisecond. And they peak exactly 1 millisecond apart. And that's the way we can actually tell the presence of the signal. And the reconstructed waveform, in this particular case, the signal was 5 times longer than the first one, 1 full second, as opposed to only 200 milliseconds, and about 55 cycles. And that's a large number of cycles, very, very useful in testing general relativity, as I'll point out. So in addition to that, this other tiny little event is not given a proper name. Instead of calling it the glorious GW, which stands for gravitational wave event, it's called LVT, a kind of poorer version, LIGO Virgo transient, as though it did not deserve the full name. But it is consistent with a binary black hole, slightly lighter than GW-150914, but heavier than the other cousin. If you look at all these three events in the data, that's how they would look like. The estimated properties of the signal tells us that the first event was short, 0.2 seconds. The second one was probably about half a second. We can't tell very, very precisely. But the third one was a full 1.5 seconds long. The significance for the second event, too, by the same process, if you don't remove any of the signals, that's the background. In that case, you have slightly less than 5 sigma or more than 5 sigma, depending on the pipeline that you use to characterize it. But once you remove that, in both cases, it's actually greater than 5 sigma. So that's what we have. So what are the properties of the signals, and what can we learn from these binary black hole signals? First of all, everybody would be interested in knowing where they came from the sky, but that's a disappointment. We really can't tell where in the sky it came from. In some coordinate system, that seems to be the area, the region in the sky where the Boxing Day event came from, much bigger area because it's a weaker event, and this is the area in the sky corresponding to the first detection. So we can't tell where in the sky they came from. Nevertheless, we can measure the masses, you know, more or less pretty well. I mean, pretty well, actually, because in the case of the first event, it's between 29 and 35 solar masses for the two events. In the second case, it's between 8 and 22 solar masses. So those are the masses that we can measure. One of the very exciting things about black holes is their spins. We know that black holes can have spin, but general relativity does not allow these black holes to... General relativity does not allow the black hole spins in some dimensionless units to be larger than one. But we do measure for one of the black holes to be something like 20% of the maximal value. That's what we conclude. For the other black hole case, that the component black holes are probably something like close to being zero, but we can't tell. The measurement is not accurate enough. But this is the first time we are able to measure the spin of one of the black holes to be as accurate as depicted here. So the distances, I mean, as I mentioned already, they came from 1.3 billion light years away. For the two confirmed events, it's similar distances. For the candidate event, it's more than 1 gigaparsec or 3 billion light years. The final spins is very interesting because that is close to something like 70% of the maximum value, 60 to 70% for the two confirmed events. It's more uncertain in the other case. One of the things that one can do once you have these is test general relativity in ways that has not been possible before. Because once you have these, they are completely described by general relativity. And one thing that you can do is to look at the evolution of the signal. And according to general relativity, these signals slowly increase in frequency, increase in amplitude, and finally they terminate in what is called quasi-normal mode ringing. And that is the signature of the final black hole. So here, the frequency as a function of time over 200 milliseconds increases in the final stages very rapidly, and then it reaches a roughly a constant value. That's a real measurement that has been made with uncertainties. Now, what this is telling us is that the peak amplitude, after reaching a peak amplitude, it immediately is going down. And we can actually identify the signature of the black hole, the so-called ringing of the black hole due to the deformity that is introduced when the two black holes merge. Initially, the remnant black hole is highly deformed, and it gets rid of its deformation by emitting characteristic gravitational waves called quasi-normal modes. And we can actually see that in the data as well. So here is the data all over again. This is the peak amplitude. We think that we have to wait a little bit after the peak amplitude is reached for a little while, about 5 milliseconds or so. And then starting from that, if we measure what is the signal-to-noise ratio, it's about 7.5. So that's the signature of a ringing black hole, first time ever observed. But we can also do something more. Namely, we can measure the parameters of the black hole purely from the quasi-normal mode ringing, but also ask the question, what is the prediction of general relativity from the inspiral part, that the two black holes are inspiraling. From that, we can tell what should be the final black hole and ask the question, is that consistent with just the quasi-normal mode ringing? And that would be the signature of the black hole itself. So these curves here tell you the quasi-normal mode decay time because they're exponentially damped. This is in milliseconds, so something like between 2 to 8 milliseconds, the black hole completely vanishes from our sight. And this is the quasi-normal mode frequency. Now, we don't know exactly when the quasi-normal mode ringing starts, so we can do after 1 millisecond, we would get, 5 milliseconds, we would get that red curve. 1 millisecond, we would get that curve. With 3 milliseconds, you get the purple curve. 6.5 milliseconds, you get another curve, and so on. But apart from this 1 millisecond, we don't believe that is when the black hole quasi-normal mode ringing. All other curves here are consistent with the masses, sorry, the quasi-normal mode decay time and frequency determined from the in-spiral part of the signal. In fact, it uses the entire signal to determine the properties of the final black hole, and the two are consistent. So this is the first proof of having observed a black hole, the first signature. But there is more to be done, because we have seen only one quasi-normal mode. Black holes have a spectrum of black holes, spectrum of modes. They emit in many different frequencies with different damping times and frequencies. And only when we measure those and show that all those modes depend only on the mass and spin of the final black hole do we have the proof that we have seen a black hole. So this is just the first glimpse of what it is. I mentioned at some point that it's possible that gravitational waves travel at less than the speed of light. This is expressed in terms of the particle analog of gravitational waves, namely graviton having some mass. So if gravitational waves travel at speeds less than the speed of light, gravitons will not be massless, but they will have some mass, and we can go and set upper limits on the mass of the graviton, and that turns out to be at the level of something like 1.2 times 10 to the minus 22 electron volt upon c squared. So a pretty tiny number. This is not the best number obtained ever. There are certain other constraints which are model dependent. What is shown here are very firm limits that come from binary pulsar that I mentioned, solar system bounds, and this is the exclusion region coming from gravitational wave observations. So when you consider the model dependent ones, this is the best ever that has been reached. There are other tests of general relativity one can do. I won't go into them. A bit technical, what are called testing general relativity, the so-called post-Newtonian approximation. I will leave that out, but I want to just briefly mention the astrophysical implications and the future of this wave. The black holes that we are seeing seem to be from a different class. Maybe their formation is different or whatever, because when you look at the masses of the black holes detected by X-rays, they are at the level of something like 5 to 20 solar masses, whereas the black holes that we are detecting are at the level of tens of solar masses. And there's been a new name initiated for this, and they're called heavy black holes. And the physics, maybe heavier black holes. Maybe they are from a different class, maybe they form in a different way. At the moment, we don't really understand how they form. We do know that they exist now, 30 solar mass black holes, 60 solar mass black holes. We know they exist. And we know the rate. This is the rate inferred from the first detection, 9 to 240 per year per gigaparsec cube volume. It is at the higher end of the predicted rate. And at design sensitivity of LIGO, which might be reached in the next 3 years, we should be observing one merger event per day. I'm personally not looking forward to it, because it's a huge amount of work. We're already spending, I don't know, something like 15 hours of telecon time every week with just, two events per year? Detecting one per day, I don't know what we would do, but that's the rate. I think I'll skip that, because that's also another thing about rate. So the other thing that we really don't understand is the formation of these binary black holes. Astrophysicists thought that the metallicity, the amount of dust in stars, is similar to that of Sun. In that case, the rate, the maximum black hole mass in solar mass as a function of the star's metallicity was around 10 to 20 solar masses. You can see that is the range. If you reduce the metallicity, make it 1/10 or 100, you can grow the black hole mass. But that's not what people thought. People thought all stars are like Sun, or maybe a little bit less metallicity in these stars. And that was what was predicted. So this is clearly telling us that the metallicity environment in which they are born, the metallicity is poorer. But one graph that I would like to show you is what we predicted or what the observations were from previous LIGO runs. Nobody cared about these graphs in the past. But these were the upper limits. These dark gray and light gray regions were the upper limits from the first LIGO observations. And these blue ones, which is the rate of events that occur as a function of these three classes of events, neutron star black hole, binary black holes, these were the limits. So we were not very close to them. Now that we have made detection, we can make the estimate of what is the rate, and that's right in this region. So you can see the detected sensitivity really improved enough for us to be in that range. For neutron star black hole and binary neutron stars, we have not yet reached that level. I'll probably show you that, but before that, what next? Currently, we are taking data. This is the second observing run. It has started. We can see in the Livingston Observatory up to something like 80 to 90 megaparsec range. This is for Hanford. It has remained more or less the same, 60 megaparsec for binary neutron stars, whereas for that, for binary, sorry, in the Livingston Observatory, slightly larger, something like 30% improvement in Livingston compared to what it was in the first observing run. What it means is that in the second observing run, there's a good chance that if we run for something like 6 months, we'll observe 10 or more events, provided sensitivity level is what was more like 80 to 120 megaparsec. We are not reached there yet, but we should expect still a few more detections in the coming months and up to the end of the year. Not only binary black holes, we expect to observe neutron stars, binary neutron stars, continuous waves from asymmetric neutron stars with mountains and stochastic backgrounds and so on. So neutron stars in particular are very interesting because unlike binary black holes, which are very boring after some time, because Harald Pfeiffer can produce very exact waveforms. If general relativity is correct, we're going to have the same pattern repeated after every time. Although I will show you some examples as to why we are not reaching anywhere close to the end of our job. So binary neutron stars, on the other hand, they have not only this interesting in spiral part. The merger dynamics is extremely interesting because it could be the result of very complex nuclear physics, magnetohydrodynamics. Everything is required to describe this situation. So they are really very, very interesting. So we have looked for those. Not that we haven't looked. So that's our upper limit now for binary neutron stars. Tantalizingly close to wave, we should start seeing according to the best predictions. For neutron star black holes, we are over there, still a little bit away. But if we can increase the volume of the universe that we can observe a little bit more, we should be seeing them. So that's the rate, 12,600 per gigaparsec cube per year for binary neutron star, 3,600 per year per gigaparsec cube in the case of neutron star black hole. By observing neutron star black holes, we can actually tell whether neutron star core consists of quarks or maybe quark gluon plasma, free quarks. And this is an extremely interesting prospect for future gravitational wave observations. Not only that, until now, we can't tell whether binary black hole orbits are simply planar, as depicted in this case, or they are in some very complicated orbits. And these are general relativistic, nonlinear general relativistic effects, which we look forward to observe in future detections. But the holy grail of this area, personally for me, is to observe the ringing of black holes in the higher order modes. It's like an atom which emits radiation in many different wavelengths and frequencies. And by observing them, we can learn about the space-time structure itself. And that's really the goal, finally. And to help us do that, we not only will have all these different instruments coming up, the LIGO detectors, but also Virgo, Kagra, and hopefully very soon LIGO India, which was funded 1 week after the detection. No, it was not intentional. There was no, you know, they were planning to fund it anyway. And that's coming along, and we hope to take data. In addition to these two instruments, we add Virgo in the coming years, Kagra in about 3 years, and LIGO India in about 8 years or so. And with that, we will observe only a part of the sky with the two LIGO detectors. These are the two LIGO detectors. There are some holes, but with the 5 detectors operating, we should be able to see the entire sky. That is supposed to show you, by the way, the sensitivity to the sky, different parts of the sky due to these detectors. I will skip a few just to say we already have plans to go beyond advanced detectors to construct instruments that are 10 times more sensitive than advanced detectors, maybe 30 times. With that, we should be able to observe these binary black holes to the edge of the universe and beyond. I say that because our reach for binary black holes in the case of these detectors like these is redshift of 50. The formation of structure probably happened much later. Maybe we won't see anything there, but it would be interesting to search for nothingness as well. With that, let me show you my summary. LIGO observations have firmly established the field of gravitational wave astronomy. The future observations should shed some light on many fundamental physics problems as well as astrophysics, cosmic history, and extreme gravity. And let me thank, like any binary black hole would tell you, thanks for listening. Yeah, so far, what we have been able to do is really the massive graviton one, but not the theory itself. The way this is going to work is that we need to have waveforms in these alternative theories of gravity, and we don't have any, except the quasi-normal mode one. That's the reason why, yeah, there are some alternative theories of gravity where, you know, if you have either a scalar tensor theory of gravity, or if the object is not a black hole, but it is some other things such as a boson star, we do have quasi-normal mode models. So I think we'll be able to test that in the coming years. Yeah. Yeah, that's a very, very interesting question, because astronomers have measured spins that are very close to extremal, something like 0.9, 0.99. I think those are probably depend significantly on the model. They are not direct measurements, although there is effort to do that, to correct for systematics. But I think this is, in some ways, completely independent of any models. You know, general relativity is the only thing that goes into those measurements. We don't need to model the disk around these massive black holes. We don't have to worry about any other environmental effects. So while there are these candidates, it would be very interesting to see whether we get maximally spinning black holes. So far, our measurements seem to indicate all the objects that we are seeing are significantly less than this maximal spin. Full-time coverage is extremely hard, mostly because it's the anthropogenic noise that is very hard to contain. I mean, you can't travel, I mean, you can't prevent people from driving around or cutting trees or running their fans in a distant, you know, especially in Hanford, there are these nuclear facilities, right? Just the fans running. Or you can't prevent aeroplanes flying. All these things are part of our noise budget. And so At the moment, we have about 50 to 60% duty cycle for each detector. And because of LIGO being where it is, in the same continent, the total duty cycle is not 25%, which is what it would be if they're completely random, you know, running. So it's more like 40%, 30%, 40%. I think in the long run, GEO detector, which is the one that I was involved for a very long time, has actually 95% duty cycle. So these detectors can be made very stable, but at the cost of sensitivity. So you have to trade between sensitivity and time. And I think it's better to have increase in strain sensitivity because that goes like the cube, whereas the time is only linear. So people actually offset, you know, that. So that's the problem at the moment. So until we reach a certain design goal, we can't run them stably for a long period. Hi. Yeah. At the moment, we can see up to about 500 solar masses. Up to 500 solar masses,
oh, really?
Actually. Yeah, yeah,
right,
yeah,
now.
Yeah,
with,
yeah.
Wow.
Especially the LIGO Livingston detector has improved significantly in lower frequency sensitivity because they have been able to reduce the scattered noise. So it, we can actually go to up to 500 solar masses.
And so that means you can, it also goes to a higher depth because the signal is higher?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely true. Yeah, we can see up to redshift of something like 1.5, no, 3, something like 3 gigaparsec, 0.5, 0.4, 0.5.
Okay,
with, yeah. Only two cycles or three cycles.
Any other questions? Otherwise, let's thank the speaker again for